now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this week we're doing things slightly differently since there's no league football, but I'm delighted to be joined by an all-star lineup of Patty Barkley, Tony Evans, and Matt Dickinson for this extra special edition of the game. Today we're focusing on the big boys, more on the continuing takeover saga at Liverpool, and also drawing from the fact that Patty has just written a book about him, the epic career of one Sir Alex Chapman Ferguson. But we begin in Liverpool, and now I appreciate, guys, the situation is sort of evolving as we speak, and we don't want to be dated here, so I'm not going to ask something like, what's the latest, but can we maybe take a step back and provide some context about why, when this deadline was approaching, why all of a sudden the board comes out and says, we've got two bids on the table, and we're the, presumably, maybe Jeffrey Wang and the Chinese being one, and John W. Henry and the New England Sports Ventures the other. Why exactly this came out now, or at least prior to the deadline? Tony?
Well, I think as we were approaching the deadline, we got a situation where Broughton, who was brought in to sell the club, isn't selling the club. And so he's tried to rush through a deal. And clearly, it's undercooked. It wasn't ready. But where it does, he can say, I've done what I'm supposed to have done. I've sold the club. You know, now let the courts decide it. The fact is, undoubtedly, it's a situation where he's set up a deal that will fail, probably the test of law. Helen Power wrote in the Times on Monday morning that the whole basis for his case was experimental. So Liverpool Football Club is the subject of an experimental law case. That's wonderful.
Okay, Dicko.
I just thought, I mean, to a degree, obviously, I mean, the reason it's coming out now is that, I mean, that he's. It's become a public war, and the deadline gives, well, in Broughton's views, gives them a lever that and a strength of position where, you know, with RBS's deadline approaching, Hicks and Gillette are entirely backed into a corner, and that the value of the club is dictated by the fact that, you know, RBS take charge, and it's going to be worth a £300 million quid that, well, to be honest, it probably should have been all along, and that Hicks and Gillette were massively inflating for their own purposes. I mean, I do disagree with Tony a bit. I mean, I can understand that clearly this is going to go to a test of law, but, you know, there's been plenty of advice that Broughton is on pretty safe ground. And you know, I think as far as I can see, he's doing the best for Liverpool. They seem, as much as you can judge on the surface, pretty credible buyers, and he's worked out a tactic that he thinks he's got Hicks and Gillette in a bind, and clearly there's risk attached, but I think it strikes me certainly on the surface as with best intentions.
Dicko, can you just explain, just for listeners who might not understand it, why is it better for Liverpool that the club be sold now rather than foreclosing?
Well, there are two various reasons. I mean, there's obviously the issue of the 9 points. I mean, I think it's interesting, this debate about, you know, whether the Americans would walk away if those 9 points were deducted. I mean, I'm hoping that that's just a game of bluff. I can't believe
they're trying to drive down the price.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'd be mortified, and Liverpool fans should be mortified if that was a genuine threat. I mean, but you know, you can't blame them if that's a negotiating position, because if you lose 9 points. you know, you do entertain the risk of bubbling along, bouncing along in a relegation zone. And clearly, you know, there's over half, there's, I think it's the best part of $750,000 per league position. And, you know, by obvious definition, you're going to lose money by the fact that you're going to finish lower down the table, by nine points lower down the table. So I think they're entitled to use that as a small negotiating position, but the idea that they would walk away is a nonsense. So, you know, there's the nine-point deduction, you know, there's the pure, you know, PR disaster for not just for Liverpool, but for the Premier League as a whole, of a great institution like that being seen to go into administration. But also, you know, clearly Broughton is trying to do this deal, you know, as a negotiation, rather than allowing the club to slip into the hands of the bankers. Is best done while the Liverpool board are in control.
Well, there's one thing about this 9 points penalty. I haven't been reporting on this story as closely as you guys have, but I simply picked up the phone and called the Premier League's chief of communications, if that's his title. Anyway, his name is Dan Johnson, and I asked him, you know, can Liverpool effectively be docked points? Is it likely they're going to go into administration? And he said, I don't see how they can be docked points, because you only get docked points if you're no longer solvent. And while Kop Holdings may become insolvent, the Liverpool Football Club would certainly remain solvent this season. Now, I realize he maybe didn't have all the facts and whatever, but can somebody explain to me how it's possible that Liverpool get docked 9 points, Paddy?
Well, the point is that they will deserve to be docked 9 points.
I'm not
saying that. I'm saying that they do stand to be docked 9 points if they are in breach of debt, if they don't pay their debts. I mean, that's what happened to Portsmouth. I mean, the idea, I mean, Dicko says that, you know, the Premier League couldn't stand the disgrace of a great institution going down. But, I mean, they claim that Leeds weren't a Premier League institution, but that's a technical point. Everyone knows that a Premier League club went down, and Portsmouth as well. This is becoming a habit. And everybody nowadays in these terrible financial times appears inured to PR disasters. I don't think the Premier League would be any different. But, yes, technically Liverpool can be docked 9 points. Whether that would send them to relegation is not clear, but it would almost certainly mean that they wouldn't play in Europe next year. Therefore, the price of the club would come down. However, if that were done, it would be the utmost cynicism, because what we have here is a fairly simple situation. We have a £300 million bid on the table. We have a £300 million debt to RBS. It should be as simple as that.
Tony.
It's the bottom line, you know, I could have told Broughton beforehand, without any legal advice, whoever buys this club or sells this club is going to have to cut a deal with Tom Hicks. No English court has ever sold a business against the wishes of its shareholders. It won't happen now. Someone's going to have to deal with Tom Hicks. Tom Hicks is going to get his pounds of flesh. It mightn't be a very big pound, but he will do.
But as you're not, I mean, the legal advice does, I mean, it seems you pick up a different paper, pick up a different legal interpretation. But, I mean, there's been plenty of our learned friends who seem to be saying that, you know, that Tom Hicks did sign paperwork when Broughton was brought in, that meant that he couldn't just reconstitute the board.
Yeah, this is just briefing, though, isn't it? I mean, it's of no value. The answer is we don't know. Helen Power in Monday's Times, the piece that Tony just referred to, makes the very good point that this will be judged probably by people who have no interest in Liverpool Football Club, and probably might not even have heard of it before. This will be done strictly on company law, which is incredibly complicated. And, you know, really all we can have, although Tony follows the situation more closely than most, all we can have is hunches.
Well, I'd say most of the stuff that's been written about this whole takeover process has been absolute nonsense because, well, let's face it, as sports journalists, we're all out of our comfort zone on this. Exactly. You know, we're dealing with stuff we shouldn't be writing about, we don't want to be writing about.
Correct.
And, you know, it's, you know, the sooner we see the back of it, the better. But, as I say, for all the manoeuvring and the politicking and the briefing that goes on, I think the bottom line is that if you're going to buy the club, you're going to have to buy it off the owners.
Which,
well, unless, I mean, that's assuming that obviously he doesn't default on the RBS loan. I mean, it's interesting, you know, you see, I mean, again, this is, as Tony quite rightly says, we are out of our comfort zone, but I was reading in the Sunday Times yesterday about, you know, Hicks's worth being estimated, you know, I think they were talking about, you know, somewhere about $800 million. Now, on that basis, you think, well, why, you know, how can he possibly default on a £300 million loan? I mean, surely, you know, he can do some, you know, raid his own piggy bank. But I mean, this is where the whole thing becomes so.
But Dicko, I don't think it means that he's got £800 million in cash.
Well, exactly, of course it doesn't. But you
you're
think
right. He should be able to if he's got £800 million in assets, as long as he's not overly stretched out elsewhere. You would think that you could get, you know, enough in to meet the interest payments and extend the loan.
Well, exactly.
But what I get from, but what I'm getting from what very little I've done from the Hicks camp, is that RBS are not cooperating here because now they have their way out. Mm. That basically now RBS are saying, you know, they're putting two fingers up to Hicks and saying, no, well, you can either pay everything up right now,
or we'll take it.
Or we'll take it. That they're not interested in negotiating anymore.
Yeah. Right, too.
I wanted to bring it back for the football a little because I'm getting, I mean, we talked a little bit about Hodgson's start last week, but I'm getting the sense here that the Hodgson has basically been seen to be blameless in this. I read about how, you know, Rafa left him this terrible squad that he couldn't have been doing any better. And I'm kind of wondering if actually, no, you know, with all the stuff in the boardroom, should Liverpool be doing better than being in the relegation zone? Is this squad that bad?
Right. You leave me a squad that has Pepe Reina, that has Steven Gerrard, that has Fernando Torres, and I can get 10 fellas out the park and finish in the top four. You know, none of the problems, none of the institutional problems are Hodgson's fault, but he has not made anything better. In fact, he's made things worse on the pitch. Mm. The reality is his buys have been poor. And to be fair, Joe Cole wasn't his buy. He was an equity trader's buy. But, you know, his buys have been poor. And he has not organised the team in the right way. His tactics have been absolutely abysmal. He hasn't worked out how to use Fernando Torres. This is a man, he can't grasp what it takes personality-wise to be manager of a Liverpool Football Club. I know he's a friend of yours, Paddy, but I'm giving him a coating, and the sooner he's out of Anfield, the better, like Tom Hicks.
Right. Well, I mean, this is nice to be in a not so much a comfort zone as a slumberland with a lovely fluffy duvet. I mean, that Roy Hodgson is not a problem. And I mean, to make the kind of judgments that Tony does, which, I mean, of course he's got every right to say them, but I just feel that they're rather premature. I mean, for example, if you look at what happened to Hodgson at Fulham, his previous employer, although we could go back to his successes with many others in many different countries for about three decades previously. But if we go look at Fulham, he went into Fulham. He wasn't expected to get into the Champions League straight away. In fact, they won only two of their first 14 games. Now, can you imagine what will be going on if he's only won two of his first 14 at Liverpool? But Fulham.
Well, we'll find out because he's on track to do
Fulham,
that.
Fulham concentrated, got on with adapting to his pattern of play. He's a pattern of play manager. He's never going to have an instant effect on a club. And it's ridiculous for Liverpool to expect him to do so, especially as Tony rightly says, they started from a fairly high point anyway. They were challenging for the title 18 months ago. If Liverpool give Roy Hodgson 14 league matches, we will not be having a conversation like this. I guarantee it.
One final thing. I'm just going to go around. One word answer. 3 months from now. Two word answer, actually. 3 months from now. So we're talking middle of January. What position will Liverpool be in the table, and who will own the club? And I'm going to start with you, Dicko.
Liverpool in January will be about 10th, generally sort of slowly upwardly mobile, but bobbling along the middle. And I'm going to charge you £1,500 an hour to tell you with my best legal advice that they will be owned by the Americans.
Well, which ones?
By the man with the big fat cigar.
That would be John W. Henry. Tony?
I agree. 10th, I disagree on the New England Sports Ventures. I think there'll be a different owner. I think we'll know by Wednesday.
Paddy?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd love to take the we'll know by Wednesday option. Can I?
No,
I mean, you let Tony do it. You let Tony do it.
What? Tony's the football editor. He gets the cop out.
Okay.
You don't.
Right. Well, I think it'll be owned by the New England lot. Henry the Second, Part Two, or whatever he's called. And I think they'll be in 12th position. I think 10th is falling into the old trap of trying for too much. You know, and forget this grand plan stuff, by the way. The short term's all Liverpool have got. They're never going to go back to where they were. So forget that forever. It's gone forever.
All right. You heard it here first. I personally think that Liverpool will be 6th or 7th because it's inevitable that Gerrard and Torres at some point will start playing well. And that's really all it takes for a two-man team. As for the owner, I think it'll still be RBS. I think they may well renegotiate a loan, but what do I know? We're going to turn our attention now to a very broad topic constituted by, I think, a man that everybody has thought about, a person who seemingly has been accompanying us for nearly five decades, and that is Sir Alex Ferguson. Now, Paddy, you've written a biography of the man. There's a bunch of biographies out there, including his own autobiography, which I've read, and which I think is really an excellent read, very well written, and truly revealing, which doesn't often happen with autobiographies. I also read the Michael Crick book, which took a slightly different look. What kind of a look is your book?
Well, mine is very, very fair. Michael Crick's book was fair, was extremely fair. Alex Ferguson's own book, though as well written as Gab says, was ludicrously over fair to himself. It was revealing of the sort of things that he wanted to reveal, and obviously not of you know scores he wanted to settle and people who were mysteriously omitted and so on. That's why I had to write this, a proper biography of him. I mean, Ferguson will have another autobiography, I think it's about his seventh, which will come out over the next 2-3 years. I'm sure it'll flow, although it won't be written by Hugh McIlvany, which is a pity. But it will only tell a massive half-truth, which is what Managing My Life did. So Football Bloody Hell, which is mine, will attempt to be fair to all, and including Sir Alex, obviously, and set the record straight. Because I mean, there was an awful lot quite early in my book. The phrase "the Ferguson mythology" comes up, and you know, we return to that quite frequently over whatever it is, 420 pages. But one thing you can't do is write a book about Ferguson that's negative. And it obviously it pays tribute to unprecedented achievements, unprecedented even by Sir Matt Busby.
Dicko, I mean, it just strikes me as weird, and I mean, you're maybe a few years older than me, but it just strikes me as bizarre that, you know, somebody who was out there and winning things when we were children is still here and still successful. I just want to go back for those who are maybe a little bit younger. When the guy started, you know, it was 2 points for a win in England. It was muddy pitches.
There was no printing presses. We didn't even have wheels. It wasn't that long ago, for God's sake. Let's not exaggerate this out of proportion. It's just the Ferguson mythology. You know, it's like, and on the seventh day, Sir Alex invented the world, and football was the world. Stop it!
It was quite a long time ago. I mean, Liverpool used to win a double every year.
It was pre-internet, which is one of the greatest. I mean, I did the Manchester beat when I were a young lad about 743 years ago. I've worked the Manchester beat for the Express, and it was so long ago, we used to have Ferguson's home number. Used to ring him up regularly on the afternoons, often wake him up on an afternoon just to ask about McLaren's hamstring, or just did he think that Paul Parker would be fit for Saturday. Now, of course, Ferguson, if you're lucky, Ferguson will appear in a press conference once a millennium and deign to answer a couple of questions before snarling at someone and walking out. I mean, it's been, from a media point of view, it's been, that tells the story of how long it's been. And, things like the internet and 24-hour news have come along and changed an awful lot, particularly including Fergie's dealings with the media, which is a great shame because, as Paddy, that's why Paddy's written, his term about him. Ferguson is a compelling character. I mean, one of the most, I've had all kinds of issues with him, gripes. He's treated me and many others with contempt at various times. But I'm still, find him a compelling, fascinating figure. And if I was having a dinner party of football characters, I'd still want him around the table because he's fascinating to observe in his strengths and his weaknesses.
Paddy, this issue of longevity, I mean, Dicko brought up McLaren, Paul Parker in the late 80s. I go further than that. This guy actually took Aberdeen, and yes, young football fans, there was a time when teams other than Celtic and Rangers won the title, although not that often. He built this fantastic.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Aberdeen side that not only won titles in Scotland, but went and took on Real Madrid and won continental titles too, which seems unconscionable now. But what gets me about sort of the fact that to play a brand of football in the early 80s and and to maintain that sort of nearly four decades later,
yes,
you need to have some modernity. Can you talk a little bit about how what that Aberdeen side, what the kind of football he played? And
oh, they were an excellent side. A lot of them were already there. He's always made a habit of youth development. And in fact, Aberdeen already had a very good youth policy when he arrived, having built one at St Mirren. And of course, it's axiomatic that he relied on youth at a crucial stage at Manchester United. But he built that side gradually. He didn't make his first signing for the best part of a year. That was Mark McGee. But it was an excellent team. It was a team that played football. It didn't go out and kick Real Madrid. It played football against Real Madrid. And it's very much a team that stands the test of time. If you are able to get YouTube footage of Aberdeen, particularly in their game against Bayern Munich, they really did play. And they came back from adversity to beat them in the quarterfinal. It was a terrific campaign. It was a terrific side. And he was ahead of his time in a sense there, in that they were an extremely fit side. Their fitness levels, I think, was Mark McGee told me. He about 20 years later, he was managing at Millwall. And they did they measured the players' fitness, and it was nowhere near the standard of the of what the Aberdeen players had been 20 years earlier.
To be fair, I think at Aberdeen, didn't Fergie go and make them go and run on the beach in the North Sea, and there's no beach at Millwall, so we've got to give McGee a pass for that, yeah?
Yeah. I'm sure Ferguson would have built one.
I should just add it, I think that was, I mean, I've read the book, and that's, I mean, my favourite stuff is the early years,
yes,
just because
me too.
Paddy, I mean, also, you know, Paddy obviously was sort of, you know, kicked around that block, so you know, there's he knows the whole thing inside out. So really enjoyed that stuff. But it's, I mean, there are so many contradictions about Fergie. I mean, we could turn this into an 8-hour podcast, because I mean, he, you know, for example, the fact, you know, I love the fact, and even Tony possibly might accept that. One of the great things about Fergie through most of his career is the sort of, you know, the love of attacking football. I mean, we should never forget that he produced teams, you know, that were just intent on attack and had a great adventurous spirit. But equally, there was a naivety about it. So, you know, which he has then tempered in recent years by trying to sort of win the European Cup with shall we say more sophisticated methods, which clearly, you know, have a, there's a logic to that, but equally, you know, slightly diminished from that early abandon. And I mean, again, I just find that one of the many fascinating contradictions of Fergie.
And when he came,
and the sort of internal, I think he's had his own massive internal sort of wrestles, mental wrestling with that.
Tony, I mean, obviously you're a fan of Up the Road. I mean, is there a grudging respect to his, as Declan Rice, to his attacking intents?
I think the team, the one that Kanchelskis and Sharp, the one they used Cantona as a pivot, and they broke as well as any side in British football. You know, and they're one of the great sides. I put them in the top five of sides I've seen. Yeah, without a doubt. And you know, he's had a remarkable career and a really impressive career. You know, I think you can't argue about any of that. I think what will be interesting to see is legacy. I mean, when you think of Matt Busby, won the European Cup, and 6 years later, Manchester United were in the old second division. I think Ferguson's legacy will be a different thing. I mean, I think the biggest question you've got to ask about him is complicity with the Glazers in the last few years.
Yes.
And where that'll leave United after Ferguson's gone. And I don't think we'll be able to judge him in the round until he's been retired 10 years.
That's a very good point.
What other choice would he have? I mean, it's, you know, he's built the great institution of Man United, and obviously he's got to, you know, the last thing he wants to do is I mean, if Ferguson had come out against the Glazers, which is a massive, I mean, it's a you know, it's like any of us suddenly deciding that Rupert Murdoch's a bad thing for the media. You know, that's a huge, huge call and potentially hugely disruptive.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, Dicko, if I jump in there, right, I appreciate the analogy you've just made, but what if you, Matt Dickinson, decided to do that after having, you know, won every award that there is to win as a journalist, after having more than £100 million in the bank, and knowing you had an enormous crowd of adoring fans who were willing to embrace you if you did that, and also knowing that you had a shot, however small, of ousting the person you were turning against? Might that shed things in a slightly different light?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's a big, you know, I think you'd probably have to, you know, like a politician deciding he wasn't, you know, he couldn't sort of go along with collective responsibility in cabinet. You'd have to do it on the way out, wouldn't you? I just don't see how Ferguson could wage an internal revolution against the Glazers. Well, I can see how he could try, but I just think, you know, I'm not comfortable with, you know, and I'm sure he isn't comfortable, and nor is David Gill. I mean, people, you know, United fans attack David Gill. David Gill is a bright guy. You know, is one of the good things about Man United generally, and it must, you know, let's not be done. I mean, it must stick in his throat an awful lot of the stuff he's had to say. But what's the alternative?
I don't think it does stick in his.
Does he quit and think, well, I think I'm doing a good job for Man United. I'm loyal to this institution, and this institution will survive a long time after the Glazers have gone.
Paddy.
Well, I mean, what we have to do is, I mean, for a start, there's absolutely no chance of Alex Ferguson turning on the Glazers, nor would he want to, because he is responsible for them. I mean, if you go back to the situation pre-Glazer. The sort of bête noire at Manchester United were Maguire and McManus, the two Irishmen, who gradually, who having been brought into the club by Ferguson, gradually fell out with him, and then he sued them. And that provided the catalyst for Maguire and McManus to build up the shareholding that enabled the Glazers to take over, and which I think the Irishman took a certain glee in making that sale, quite apart from the huge profit they took, which was over £200 million. So Ferguson was complicit, whether he liked it inadvertently, in that. He then decided, apparently decided, that his only chance was to swing straight behind these Glazers, which he did. The problem is that Ferguson's embeddedness with the Glazers regime is the truth that dare not speak its name for a million Manchester United fans. They cannot confront the fact that as well as making this club, he has also, if the green and gold people are to be believed, also seriously weakened it.
Tony, that's kind of a really depressing thought, because for the reasons I outlined before, if there's one person in British football, north or south of the border, who you would think could write his own rules, yes, after what he's achieved,
correct,
It would be Sir Alex Ferguson. And had he stood up, even if he could have, he might have won. B, even if he loses, he rides off in the sunset. He becomes truly immortal. He could go manage FC United of Manchester, attract all the sponsorship in the world, and he could have written a different story. Is it fair of us to have even suggested that?
He's always written his own rules. He can square any circle. He's the socialist who takes a knighthood. He's the union organiser who's the ultimate company man. You know, these are parts of his character, and this is what makes him actually a fascinating character. You know,
yeah, socialism is a facade.
And the flaws, sort of within him. The reality is, what suited him at the time was to support the Glazers. When it ceases to suit him, he'll turn on them.
Football fans being what they are, I don't think I would say he's absolutely fireproof. I'd say no matter what happens to Manchester United now, the last person that will be given a shred of blame will be Sir Alex Ferguson.
He will quit in the next within a couple of seasons. Gill will almost certainly walk with him. Now, and both of them will be, colossally missed. I mean, I'm not saying they're irreplaceable. There are bright executives out there, and there are even a few managers who are better than Alex Ferguson.
Excuse me.
Well, Jose, if Jose,
stop it, please. Can we just not mention that name on this show? Well, can we just not come out and say that he's better than Sir Alex Ferguson, which is the way you were going, and not turn this into a debate about that man? He does not need to infect every facet of our lives. He's a million miles away.
Matt Dickinson doesn't need anybody to defend him, but I will say, having studied Alex Ferguson for 2 years, that in my opinion, in terms of actual talent, he doesn't compare with Jose Mourinho or Brian Clough. Brian Clough was certainly a genius, and Jose Mourinho will probably prove to be one. Ferguson is not a genius.
Right. Ferguson, in many ways, he's created his own luck, but he was lucky. He came along at just the right time when football was changing and when a huge amount of money poured into the game, and Manchester United in particular. I mean, famously, he said he knocked Liverpool off their effing pitch. The reality is he didn't. He filled a vacuum. Liverpool's decline started 2 years earlier.
It was Arsenal who knocked
the league
Liverpool
before
off
him.
Exactly.
Worried, I thought it was Graeme Souness who knocked Liverpool off.
He did, without a doubt.
But Ferguson, he's a colossal force of personality.
Of course,
he is. I mean, I agree with that. The fact is that he had to sort of learn tactical sophistication as he went along, and was still learning it at 55, 60, 65, and that's, which says that he clearly lacked something previously.
But that's also a mark of pride, isn't it? I mean, to be able, at age 60, to come out and say, I can learn from this guy, I can learn from Carlos Queiroz, I can learn from Walter or whatever.
Well, exactly, that's one of his strengths as well. I mean, the other thing we should, one of the main reasons for his longevity is delegation. I mean, the fact is he has taken less than 10 training sessions at Manchester United in about the last 20, 30 years. I mean, he just doesn't do it. He wanders over, he's got a phone, you know, you might be speaking to Ladbrokes, you might be speaking to another coach, you might be, but you know, he has learned to bring in coaches, and he sort of gives them a blueprint of what he's looking for, but they do a lot of the detail. And I mean, I'm not saying that as a criticism. It's one of the reasons why he's still going strong as an old man. But it's you know, it's just interesting. He's not out there on the coaching field, that's for sure. And you know, I mean, the greatest tribute to him, I think, to be honest, is, you know, you speak to Neville's, Scholes, Butt, Giggs, all those guys, and you know, they've been brought up as, you know, as decent human beings, to be honest. And that is, you know, something that he can claim. You know, he's become a very paternal figure to those to those guys, and it's commendable.
For all his faults, Jose Mourinho tells you, was one of the people I spoke to for the book, told me that about what happened after Manchester United were rather unjustly knocked out by Porto at Old Trafford. I can't remember the year, but it was the time when Mourinho ran along the touchline wildly celebrating. And after that game, the Porto players were sitting there, you know, screaming and yelling as in the dressing room as if they'd won the cup itself, according to Mourinho, and there was a knock on the door. In came Ferguson and the aforementioned Gary Neville, and they came in, they said, "Congratulations, lads, you deserved it," shook hands with every player, and Mourinho said, as they walked out the door again, there was total silence and total respect for what they'd done. And I thought that story was one of the most moving I had in all the time that I, you know, the 2 years that I researched Ferguson's character.
Paddy, can you please tell us, the book's called Football Bloody Hell. What's the genesis of the title? I mean, I think we all know.
As with so many things, it's Sir Alex who's to blame. Asked a simple question by Gary Newborn after the Champions League final of 1999. He said, "Football, bloody hell." And I must say, I don't disagree with a syllable of that.
And Paddy's marketing campaign will bite it, you bastards.
Time now for what my producer calls Off the Fence, and what I like to call Quick Hits. Carlitos Tevez says he considers himself a, quote, old man, and hinted that he has thought of quitting football at age 26. Paddy, is this a footballer's equivalent of a midlife crisis? And why, bust-ups with Mancini aside, would he say this when he's on one of the very best runs of his career?
Absolutely. I think he was just thinking aloud. I mean, we all go through days like that. The fact is that Carlitos is going through the greatest form of his life. He's holding up the Manchester City attack and, you know, making himself already a candidate for Footballer of the Year. So I wouldn't take it too seriously. And by the way, the bust-up in the dressing room with Roberto Mancini, a wonderful case of creative tension.
And I think probably not much different from what generally happens in most dressing rooms.
Absolutely.
Just different. Some clubs are leakier than others. Neither Bobby Zamora nor Kevin Davis went to the World Cup, and now they're both in the England squad. Zamora has scored a grand total of 12 league goals since the summer of 2007, which, for those keeping track at home, is 12 more than Matt Dickinson has. Kevin Davis is uncapped, which is as many caps as Matt Dickinson has, and he turns 34 in March. So, Matt Dickinson, does all this sound reasonable to you?
So you're extrapolating from this that I've got a chance of the England squad, despite being uncapped and 41. Reasonable. I can see why Capello has had to turn to them, but rather than a sort of happy story about you know, Zamora and Davis and you're never too old, I think it does tell us something slightly depressing about the standard of English centre-forwards.
Brad Friedel has made 235 consecutive appearances in the league and at age 39 goes out of contract at the end of the season. Tony, should the Villa be racing to re-sign him? And could he be a short-term solution for a Champions League club?
Well, he's a good keeper and I don't think he's finished yet. You know, it's he's solid. I mean, obviously Villa will look and see if there's anything else better out there, but I don't see they will find anything else out there. And yeah, I think Arsenal could do with him, that's for sure.
Maybe if you're Villa, it's time to find out if Brad Guzan can actually play. Robbie Keane is reportedly unhappy at his limited playing time at Spurs, and with the possibility of Harry Redknapp shifting more and more to a one-striker system, being the fourth forward doesn't really bode particularly well. Paddy, Keane has turned down a move to Turkey, and clubs in England are scared off by his wages. If you were his advisor, what would you suggest?
I would never be his advisor, because what I'd suggest is lower your wages, son. I mean, Robbie Keane, I think his career is the funniest I've ever... He's a permanent misfit. He always plays well, never has a bad game, yet everybody wants to sell him or he wants to go. I don't know what it is. I honestly haven't a clue. So, actually, I don't know what to suggest. I give up.
Maybe he needs to make some more money. Mark Hughes said last week that what he has achieved in the Premier League is better than, and I quote, some guy who won a trophy in Holland, Switzerland, or France. Dicko, are you buying his argument? Is it better to be, say, sixth or eighth in England than first elsewhere?
Well, let's get Steve McLaren on the phone. I'm sure he can give a pretty good retort the other way. I mean, most of all, for someone like Mark Hughes, is not daft, certainly not a thing. So I just found it slightly depressing, sort of blinkered type statement. I mean, you could argue what is it fantastic to win the league in Switzerland? What does that achieve? But well, if an Englishman went over there, it would show a bit of interest in a wider world. It would show a bit of interest in exploring, in perhaps learning a few things, something as radical as that. So, there's no need to make the comparison. But let's not get all sort of little Englander.
Mark Hughes, of course, is Welsh, so he could care less about English managers, but some of you folks here are English. I'm looking at you, Tony, although you might...
I'm Scouse, I'm not English.
Okay, so then you're perfectly impartial on this one. Mm. Speaking of English managers, here's one you like. Tony, name the three best English managers currently in work and under the age of 60.
I think Steve McLaren, quite patently. I think now he's found humility. He's all the better. Ian Holloway, I like Ian Holloway. He's funny, he's up and coming. And I think one for the future would be Paul Tisdale of Exeter City. I think he's got a bit of talent. Is he English? I don't even know, but I'm going to give you his name.
There you have it. Tisdale, Holloway, McLaren. Something borrowed, something blue, something old, something new.
Anyway, Gab, one for you. You're not going to get out of this one. Italia. Faded champions of the world was a scoreless draw against Northern Ireland on Friday. Really the best your boys could manage.
Right now, yes. And we actually played reasonably well. We just couldn't finish. And we're sort of at our level right now. And I think Northern Ireland at home, they were certainly G'd up. I thought they played well. I mean, I think the fact of the matter is we're not particularly good right now. But then again, you don't really need to be particularly good now. You need to be particularly good come tournament time. You can go to www.thetimes.co.uk for all your news, your gossip, your analysis, the web chats. I do mine Mondays, Ollie K does his Wednesdays, and we've got others littered throughout the week. Or you can also write to us at gamepodcast@timesonline.co.uk. That's gamepodcast@timesonline.co.uk. And guess what? That is exactly what Mr. Michael Warren has done, and Michael Warren takes issue with Tom Dart and Alison Rudd, who aren't here to defend themselves, but also you, Tony. So I expect a capsule response here. This is what Michael Warren writes. Let's punish people afterwards and give De Jong a 6-game ban? Question mark. Well, if we're going to do that, how are Liverpool going to survive in the Premier League without one of the players he lists as the reason they should be higher on the table when Stevie G gets a 6-game ban every 7 games for use of an elbow? I think basically he's arguing.
Oh, Michael, 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 you're using the lousiest, most morally bankrupt argument in the world. And frankly, go look at yourself in the mirror and imagine my backside.
So if you enjoy that, if you're the kind of person who if you're the kind of person who enjoys that kind of treatment from our panelists, please write to us the way Michael Warren's done at gamepodcast@timesonline.co.uk. Thanks for spending the last 35 minutes with us. That's all we've got time for. The laughing in the background you hear is Patty Barkley.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.